grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its fucking house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. In a recent article for Writer's Digest magazine, I wrote that the best stories of witches, in my opinion, are stories in which the author figures out that it's never really about the magic. We're not reading stories about witches and werewolves and vampires and all of those supernatural things. About the magic itself. It's really cool. It's cool to see, you know, a deep dive into how the magic of this supernatural world works and all of that. That's cool. That's fine. But it doesn't really hit home unless the message isn't just about the magic, but about the power that it gives the character to take back their lives, to put them in control of their own situation. Nowhere have I seen that done better lately than in the newest graphic novel, Squad, which is written by my guest today, Maggie Takuda Hall. In Maggie's graphic novel, there is a young girl named Becca who joins a school that looks a lot like a real-life school because it's based on a real-life school, and very quickly realizes that she doesn't quite have the power that she wants to change her circumstances, to become part of a squad, to become part of the cool kids, to be accepted for once. The tagline for the book is, you know, would you kill to belong? Would you kill to belong? And the thing is, what Becca finds is that she's, oh my gosh, she's suddenly surrounded by a squad of not just empowered young women, but empowered young werewolves. It's really great because Squad has been optioned for television development and might be coming to a screen near you. So this could be a cool conversation to listen to for a future TV show in the works. Anyways, I am really excited to welcome back Maggie Takuda Hall to Inciting a Riot. Enjoy the interview. Maggie Takuda Hall, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me again.
Oh my gosh, of course. I am so happy to be celebrating Squad with you. Your first graphic novel?
It is my first graphic novel, but not my last, so that's exciting.
Oh, ooh, do we have breaking news?
It's not breaking. It got announced a little while ago. I have another one coming out in 2024. Feels like a very long time from now. But
I get how publishing schedules work, which probably means you've gotten it. You wrote it like last week, and it's.
I wrote it when I was pregnant with Noah. It sold a week after he was born, and it is scheduled for 2024.
I love this.
And it's about dirtbag samurais, and it's called The Worst Ronin.
Oh, I love this.
I'm very excited.
I love that so much. So, but I do want to go ahead and chat with you today about Squad. Wrote and Lisa Sterl illustrated. Big shout out to Lisa Sterl, who folks that listen
to this. She's incredible.
Yeah, folks that listen to this podcast will probably know she's the one responsible for the comic Witch Blood and the Modern Witch Tarot deck and a bunch of other stuff that people probably know and love. So big shout out and love to her. But I want to talk about this story and I want to know where it came from.
Okay. Yeah, well, Squad is set in Piedmont, which is the real town that I grew up in. It's a suburb. It's its own city inside of Oakland in California. Basically, a bunch of rich white people in the early 1900s were like, well, we don't want to be part of Oakland. So they made their own city. So it's surrounded on all sides by Oakland. Just to give you like a little bit of a glimpse into what kind of town it is. It's extremely privileged. It's very white. It's very rich. And when I graduated from Piedmont High, I was really mad. I'd seen a lot of things that really hurt me and hurt people around me. Obviously, toxic masculinity is a subject that I'm interested in all of my work. But its particular effects on cis girls and this sort of demands on their constant perfection and obedience while simultaneously being kind of brutalized, was the inspiration for Squad. I knew when I graduated that I wanted to write something someday that sort of told the truth about what it felt like to be there. And it took me such a long time. I tried so many times and it was never right. And then one day I realized I wanted to tell a story about girls from Piedmont who were werewolves. And it was like to the races from there. I wrote the first draft of Squad in like a week because I was just like on fire with it. And now it's a whole book that Lisa illustrated and did such a beautiful job with. And I'm so proud of both of our work on it. What a match made in heaven from my perspective anyway. Lisa's been a complete angel to work with and she's so talented and it's so wonderful to get to see it so embodied now by her work as well.
You know, I appreciate that you kind of talk about how difficult it is or it was to write about Piedmont. As a writer myself, it can be really hard. We want to write about home a lot. I mean, that's what made us, right? But so often going back into those waters, diving back into those waters is perilous because that's the closest to home. That's the closest to inside. Becca is, I don't know her full ethnic background, but she's at least her mom's Asian and she is Asian.
That's kind of a little Asian joke for just me. Cause Piedmont was so white. And so, you know, the fact that I was half Japanese and Fiona Chan was full Chinese, like, didn't matter. It was just, you're all Asians. And I don't know why I thought that was so funny. And I still think that that's so funny. And I love that they actually don't give her a chance to answer. Like, one of them asks, I think Marley asks.
Marley.
And then she gets talked over. And I was like, yep, that's how it feels. That's how it feels all the time.
So I wanted to ask about that because you know, one of the things that we are never supposed to read our own reviews,
right?
But I was interested in what the world had to say about Squad, especially as I was, prepping for the interview today. No. And I was interested in seeing how there are folks that read books like yours, but it's not just about yours. I was also like reading Keisha Blaine's new book, Until I Am Free. Just lots of books that are, you know, on my to be read pile authors of color. And I think it's really interesting how people hop in reviews and say, you know, I'm white, but I think that the way that race or microaggressions or whatever is handled by this author of color is not right.
It's wrong because it's not instructive. White people get real in their feelings when you show racism as you experience it, but don't tell them how to do better. And I think that that's hilarious, and I will not stop. It's not my job to educate you.
I loved it because the thing, I mean, I read it. I mean, I've read this twice now. And sure, I mean, you know, as a person that experiences microaggressions and oppressive behavior from time to time, you know, you recognize those kinds of things. And you, but at some point, it's not Becca's job to constantly fight every battle all the time. And in fact, the first person to kind of provide a microaggression is the girl she ends up with.
Marley is constantly saying racist shit to Becca. And Becca doesn't care because Becca's got a boner for Marley. I think, like, it's not that she doesn't care. That's not fair. But, like, I think that she's willing to let certain things slide. And I think if you talk to most people of color who've had to hack it in primarily white spaces, and you have like a couple of choices. Either you can be constantly exhausted and like explaining things to people and being the person who's willing to educate them. You can be a person who's unwilling to educate them, but also willing to call them out. And I think that that's the bravest option. And certainly not the one that somebody who will literally die to belong would take. Becca is somebody who will kill people if it means she gets to belong. So she's going to let some microaggressions slide. And I think that you will find that anyone who is hungry for proximity to privilege, is going to let things slide. She is not going to be the character who calls things out. The only one who I think is going to mature into the type of person who will be Amanda. But it's not mm-hmm. going to be Becca. Becca murders people so that someone will be her friend.
But do you find, so Amanda is, mm-hmm. she's in the squad. She is mm-hmm. Probably the token Black character in the squad.
For sure.
If Becca is the token Asian, then Amanda is the token Black character. And she certainly feels like that sometimes. And she calls that out. Is she calling this out because, you know, she truly feels like it's aggression, or just in the same way that Becca lets things slide, is Amanda using it as a power play?
I think she's calling it out because she's sick of it. Mm. Like, she's tired of it. Like, she's done this. By the time we meet Amanda, she has already suffered through so much shit that Becca is just brand new into. So Becca's a lot more willing to suffer a lot of things than Amanda is, because Amanda's been doing this presumably for as long as she's lived in Piedmont.
Sure.
Becca just got there. So her energy for white people nonsense is a lot higher than Amanda's is. And I really loved writing Amanda's character because I didn't want her to ever be a person who's like, hey, what you're doing is wrong because X, Y, and Z. She's a person who just has her own sense of what's right and what's wrong and what she's willing to suffer. And ultimately, she's the person whose decisions bear the most consequence in this story. And I loved that for her. I loved that she got to be so powerful without having to be a mouthpiece for, you know, my beliefs, or, you know, what I would hope a young Black woman in Piedmont might feel. Like, I tried to empower her in more quiet, quiet's the wrong word because it has a, she's not quiet. I tried to empower her in ways that were like directly applicable to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she has the most bearing on the plot.
Oh, she for That's sure it. Does. She for sure
yes,
does. And she provides an interesting twist at the end of the book. Since we are talking about that, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, do you agree with how Amanda handled things in the end? I mean, you wrote it, so part of you must agree. Yeah, part of you must at least be able to see her side.
Yes, I can absolutely see her side. I think I should say I don't agree with anything the girls do, really. I don't believe in the death penalty as much as I hate rape culture. So I do think that they're already taking things to like kind of a wacky place that I wouldn't have gone. I think Amanda has the strictest sense of righteousness of all four of the girls. She's the only one with anything close to a moral center. And so given the parameters of her problem, I think she did the best that she probably could. And, you know, I get asked a lot if like there'll ever be a sequel, and I don't know, but if there was, it would definitely follow Amanda to Stanford, because I do think that she's a person with like a lot of power, and it would be interesting to see her mature a little bit more into it. She's still a kid. Like, this is YA. She's 17 and she's making life or death decisions. And so it's not, I don't think right and wrong are the best lenses to look at anything in this book with.
Oh, for sure. Like, oh, this that's just not... this is all morally dark gray territory.
Yeah, like,
this is nobody comes out of this looking good.
Vigilante justice place. So when you're already in the vigilante justice place, like, yeah, she probably did the best that could be done when you're dealing with teenage girl werewolves.
So that's the thing. I think I probably buried the lead a bit, but Squad is a squad of first three girls, then four, once Becca joins. We've got a very sort of classic trope. I mean, we've got some Heathers in here. We've got some Clueless. We've got some The Craft. We have Mean Girls. There was a moment of The Sandlot in there, too, which I appreciated very much.
What moment of The Sandlot is in there?
Where the mom tells her that you need to get into trouble for crying out loud. And I was like, oh!
Oh my god! Yeah!
Yes! Oh, I was like, oh! I love a Sandlot moment. Yes! So, but I partially because of the story, partially because of Lisa Stirl's brilliant artwork, it is a story that feels both classic. It would be really easy for you to get 20 pages into this and think, oh my gosh, this feels like 30 stories I've read already, but also it's so incredibly contemporary because each time somebody tells a story like this of where the camera is focused on the women, on a squad of women and not just women as side pieces for teen boy male ego. But anytime the camera is focused on them, there are some similar elements. I very much appreciated the fashion montage. Thank you. But I appreciate that each time a type of story like this is told, that it's told with a different point of view. What is Squad's point of view? Because it's a squad of teen werewolves that punish rapey boy jerks by eating them.
I mean, I guess my philosophical center coming at it was I wanted to provide revenge fantasy for people who have been abused by rape culture. But I also wanted it not to be quite so simple. I think revenge is a really simple premise, and one that is most satisfying when it's complicated, because it never, I mean, like the universal truth of revenge is that like it never actually does the trick. It never makes you feel better, never serves as justice. It's not a replacement. But we exist in a world where our justice system doesn't serve victims of rape culture. We don't really have anywhere to go. And so on the one hand, I wanted to provide a fun, like, wouldn't that be fucking awesome if just this one time we had all the power to like get back at this, while still questioning what it means to have power at all. I am one of those people who thinks that power corrupts absolutely. I know that's kind of grim and that's sort of a sad thing to talk to teenagers about, but I think at once it's incredibly enticing and there are reasons why we feel like I'm the person who should wield it this time. And you're not wrong to think those and feel those things, but when you do, how do you make those decisions? And for me, the question of Squad is, could I trust myself with that kind of power? And the answer is no. No, I could not. This is what it would look like if I had that kind of power. And it's not right. Like, that's not justice. I don't trust myself. I think that someone like me has too much anger to wield power responsibly. And so I don't know if that's its point of view, but it's certainly its philosophical center is about questioning what we do with power and if you can ever wield it responsibly.
The thing that keeps coming up in the story, and the thing that personally I felt differentiated it from a Heather's, a Kraft, a Mean Girls, whatever, was the resurgence of the conversation about rules, society's rules. There's this concept amongst the squad of the rules, capital T, capital R, the rules that the squad has for each other about, you know, how to not get caught and the kinds of boys to eat and the kinds of boys to leave alone and yada, yada, yada. But you do have a lot of conversations throughout the story about rules and the way that we abide by them, whether or not we are conscious of the rules that we're abiding by. The mom has rules.
Yes. And
as explicit as the rules are amongst the squad, I think the really fine storytelling is done when the mom is talking to her about the reasons why they moved to Piedmont.
Yeah.
So,
well, I'm very touched because I loved writing those scenes.
They're brilliant. I wanted to just live inside them and I was just eating popcorn and just like watching mom and daughter just kind of like throw eyes at each other. But I was curious because that felt the most personal. It felt like that was when Maggie was sort of being very personal, talking about not just the rules, but about, you know, that conversation with mom. So talk to me a little bit about the social rules as you know, you injected them into Squad.
I mean, to me, they're not her mother's rule. Her mother is just sort of a conduit for obedience to the patriarchy, for lack of a less punchy way to put it. She's constantly policing her own body and Becca's body. There's like a little tiny moment where she's watching TV on her iPad as Becca leaves, and it's like a blow his mind ad for like some kind of lingerie product or something.
Ripped,
and you get the sense
apart.
That, yeah, and she's like
apart.
Just looking for a rich husband to take care of her, you know, like that would be a lot easier than doing all the, you know, work she's been doing, she thinks, except for that clearly that path had not worked for her before, and she's sort of unable to think outside of that system. And I think that Becca's really mad about that. She can see it happening. It annoys her. I don't think she has the vocabulary yet to be like, hey, mom, you're a patsy for the patriarchy and you don't need to be. And the fact that you're doing that is hurtful to me because it devalues my own sense of womanhood because you're the person I look to define that for myself. But that's what's happening. It's like she's watching her own mother pick herself apart into something smaller and less powerful because that's what she thinks it's going to take to make it, whatever the fuck that means to her. And Becca is smart enough to know that that's not the way. And I don't think that if Louise was not the way that she is, I don't think Becca would be susceptible to the Squad. The fact that her most central authority figure in her life is somebody who she can't trust to establish a sense of their self outside of this, despite the fact that her daughter desperately needs her to, she wouldn't be enticed by a group of girls who are like, hey, we murder someone once a month. Want to kick it? And Becca instead is like, fuck yeah, I do. Yeah, let's do this. Because for once, she's seeing people she thinks operating outside of this system. And of course, they're not. They police each other's bodies with, I would say, even more brutality than her mother does her own. But just the opportunity for her to imagine a world where that isn't the way that she has to look at herself is so enticing that she's literally willing to kill. And I would imagine a lot of cis girls feel the same way sometimes, where like you see your mother dieting again, you see her, you know, taking shit at work because of who she is and not being able to assert herself the way that she ought to be able to, and it makes you mad. And I think one of the reasons sometimes girls resent their mothers is because we resent them for not being as powerful as we know they are.
Mm.
And when they do that, they're also telling us that we can't be that powerful either. And that's sort of like the awful message that Louise is constantly sending Becca, even though she is actually, I think, a good mom. She's trying her best. She gives her a good home. She keeps her fed. She keeps her clothed. She loves her. She's there for her when things are bad. She just wants her to go, like, have fun. But she also comes with all this baggage, and she can't help that.
Well, you made her a human mom.
Person.
I
mean,
yeah, you made
she's
her
a human.
Human.
Mom.
Yeah. And the thing is that so many times, especially in a story like this, I mean, you know, think back to all of our other teen squad dramedies.
Yeah.
Plenty of times the parents are just sort of put in this either absent parental role or perfect parental role. Either
yeah.
the mom
either
comes
you
in,
have the parents
she's
from
floating
EVA.
In, and she's got the she's got the pearls and the heels, and she's just mom.
Mm-hmm.
Or the parents are never part of the story whatsoever, and you've given us a mother who is pretty openly trying to put a brave face on the fact that she played by society's rules. She got married. She did everything she was supposed to. The husband was still a dickbag and cheated on her, and, you know,
infidelity happens. I just think that it's extra cruel when it happens to somebody who spent their entire life being obedient.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the real for me, the like, ugh, of getting cheated on as a woman is not just the infidelity, because infidelity happens and monogamy is difficult. But I think that there is something like extra insulting of like, what else did you want from me? Like, I have been obedient for so long and still this happens to me. And I feel like that's the anger and like the presence that Louise brings to this world. It's like, doesn't matter. You can do everything right.
What does Beyonce say? You can do everything right. You can be perfect and still lose.
I get so heated about Jay-Z cheating on Beyonce. Still, it's not my business.
Or
they are adults.
The cheated on Halle Berry. Like, the fuck.
I just
why?
It still makes me mad. It's not my business. Celebrities' lives aren't my business, and yet here I am. Like, how fucking could you?
100%. So I do appreciate that Becca is raised in a house with rules, a house that respects traditions, and like you were kind of talking about, sort of not subservience but obedience to rules and to society and to patriarchy. But she does trade one set of rules for another set of rules, and there's an attraction. There seems to almost be an attraction to having rules. Okay, so yeah, you can be part, but there's more rules here.
Yes, I think rules are incredibly attractive.
tell me about that. What's attractive about rules?
Okay, if you're a person who's never fit in, right? Like, you just like are always a loser and you don't know why. If there are rules to follow and then you will fit in, holy shit. Mm-hmm. Like, all you've been waiting for your whole life is someone just to tell you what the secret rules are so you can get along with other girls. And then they will like you and you won't be so weird anymore. And Becca gets that. Like, she gets that moment of like, this is it. Like, all this time I've been a weirdo and now they're just going to tell me what rules to follow. Done. I'll never eat lunch again. No problem. And she's so desperate for that. And I feel so much for her. Like, pity is not the right word, but I feel such a sense of sadness for her that she's just so lonely and desperate that was enough. And beyond being enough, it was more than enough. It was like better than she could have ever imagined, because finally she had friends and she finally gets to feel powerful. And it's like, it's not until I feel like the very last minute that she starts to question what that means. And by then it's kind of too late in a lot of ways.
Would you take the bite?
No.
Is there a time when you would have?
Yes. High school. Would you take the bite?
Now?
Yeah, now. Now would you take the bite? He has to think about it.
Oh no. No. Yeah. I guess if you have to think about it, there's at least some yes in there, right?
Okay, it has to be. Imagine it this way, though. It's not just would you take the bite. It's three of the coolest people you've ever met in your whole fucking life who wield all the power that you wish you had come up to you. And they're like, listen, here's the deal. You can be one of us. We'll tell you all the rules that it takes to be just like us.
Okay.
And we're going to punish people you don't like who hurt you specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, this is really making me horny. I'm very horny for this bite right now.
Yeah, it's enticing, you know? Like, it's a sexy idea.
It is a sexy idea.
I would say no, just because I, like, am squeamish about violence. But as a teenager, I would have been like, which leg? Let's get biting.
you know, for somebody who's squeamish about violence, you sure do write some books with some swashbuckling violence.
I know, I have a problem. My imagination is such an unfriendly place. I wish it weren't like this. I love people like Becky Chambers who write like science fiction with like really high stakes, but they're like never violent. Everyone's safe. It's just sort of like, I don't know. She has such a beautiful and hopeful and optimistic imagination. And I don't. My brain is just like a horrible swamp creature constantly imagining other ways that I could die. So, like, oh well, so it goes.
Yeah. Is there a through line in your work, do you think, of a touch of violence and a touch of what if I made my own rules?
Yes, I do. I think I am always questioning what justice means, and that begs questions about violence and rules. Mermaid, the Witch, and the Sea is largely about justice on sort of like a national scale. Squad is obviously about rape culture and justice. The Worst Ronin, which is doesn't come out for a while, but that one's like largely about when somebody has hurt you, what does justice look like? When someone takes someone from you, like if someone in your family is killed. And then the sequel to Mermaid, the Witch, and the Sea, which I'm editing now, is also about national, like international justice, and like what does that look like? How do you create justice after one empire has done so much damage?
There's a sequel.
Baby, there's a sequel.
Oh my god. Get into my veins. Give me the sequel now.
I'm having such a hard time editing it. But yeah, the plot's banging. I'll say that much. I'm very proud of the plot. But I have to do some like tense changes and stuff like that. And boy, if you want the boringest edits that are also like painful to do, you can't outsource them because you have to make so many judgment calls.
I know.
Anyway, that's what I'm working on right now.
Yeah. Our mutual friend, Meg Ellison, pointed out that the common through line in my work seems to be, what if my parents loved me?
What? Oh, baby. Oh, no.
She's like, you keep writing these very pastoral, no matter what, I mean, you know, if it's like there's political violence or there's this or there's that, she's like, you just keep asking the question, like, what if I had parents that loved me? I'm just like, oh no, oh, that's, man. Okay, so that's what I've been paying a therapist for.
Don't call Megan unless you're ready to have real talk. That's
no,
the thing, baby.
No, no, not at all. Not at all.
Oh, I love her.
I do. I always make friends with people who are better than you at things because it's great.
It's the best.
So let's talk about sort of teen dramedies, generally speaking, because Squad easily.
Have the movie rights been sold, by the way? Are you, is there casting announcements?
Yeah, there's a TV deal, but that's kind of it for right now.
Yes.
No casting or anything like that, but it's Picture Start and Lionsgate are the two who have the rights to it. So that's a studio and a production company, and then they need like a channel to put it on. But they're going TV with it, which I think is dope.
That would be amazing. I would love to be killed. So if anybody involved with the casting listens to this, I will say I look exactly like the last blonde guy that they kill. So I'm just putting that out there.
Oh, it's Stanford?
Yeah. I'll be the Stanford. God, y'all can kill me at Stanford. That's fine. I'm 100% okay with that.
Oh my God, you do look a little like him.
I do. It's bad. In a bad way.
Yeah, but your hair doesn't say I date rape people. And I feel like that's what his hair says. His hair says...
We could make my hair say that.
I have taken advantage of people. And your hair says I'm a lovely little wood nymph. Please don't hurt me. Like, am I wrong?
I let my hair rest today. So thank you for saying that it looks like anything other than, did you try? Did you try? Oh my God,
you're adorable. Quit it.
You're precious. okay, so talk about some of the influences. Let's talk about some of these other sort of supernatural teen dramedies.
I consider it Jennifer's Body's daughter.
I was trying to find a way to bring up Jennifer's Body.
It's because Jennifer's Body's daughter. Like, I think Jennifer's Body, more than any other single piece of media, helped me develop the sense of humor that's central to this story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what Jennifer's Body does best is putting the horror up against the absurdity of being a teenager. I think that it's brilliant and perfect, and everyone needs to watch that movie. And I don't know what else to say except for that I'm obsessed with it. and I love it, and it holds up so well, and I love it, and I want.
And there's also never been a sequel.
There's never been a sequel.
There's never been a sequel. Sometimes things are perfect and leave open-ended questions.
Perfect. The Power by Naomi Alderman is probably the other book that had the most influence on it. It's the book about in a world where women, cis women, one day just start getting the ability to electrocute men to death, and men have none of that power, and it like completely shifts every geopolitical, you know, thing in the entire world. And it's another one where I really appreciated that she gives us the time to indulge in the revenge fantasy aspect of it while still asking something more deeply. And that was something I was really concerned with as well. And then, you know, people always say like Heather's, Mean Girls, whatever. I didn't watch those movies a ton like everyone else did.
I've seen Heather's once.
Yeah,
that was enough for me.
Hadn't really seen Heather's. I know I've seen bits and pieces of it, and I enjoyed parts of it, but mostly I was just sort of unsettled. And I
rewatched
Mean Girls recently and hated it.
Really?
Spicy hot take. Yeah, I didn't like it. And what I will say about all of those is that they didn't. There's so many reasons. The casual racism constantly is exhausting.
Wait, but like, you just said it was fine. What?
No. It's not that casual racism is fine. It's that when a person of color writes about casual racism is different when a movie that centers a white person,
that's true,
and only white people,
that's
is
true,
racist to background characters.
Tina Fey is not really the right person to write about racism.
No, it's a really different power dynamic than me, an Asian person, writing a story about my Asian main character who experiences casual racism and doesn't call it out because she's just so excited to be there, is really different than Asian characters in the background who literally none of them speak English and like are treated like they're not even human beings. They're just set dressing. They're just punchlines. That's really different. Tina Fey, God damn it, Tina. Like,
you had one job.
She had so many jobs and she did so many of them well, but one of them that she really fucking shit the bed on was racism. She's not good at it.
There is a through line in her work where she does tend to lean on racist, homophobic,
racist
and transphobic stereotypes from like the 80s. Like she keeps wanting to make like those. I feel like she really wants to write a movie for John Belushi. Like, just really bad.
Yeah.
Wants to write a movie
and
for
bless
him.
Her. Like, I get it. That's formative for you, but also I'm so tired of it.
Yes.
And also, you want to tell me that the two smartest, most powerful girls in that high school, Regina George and Lindsay Lohan's character, whose name I already forgot, are going to compete over some fucking boy? We can do better than that. Like, writing-wise, I feel like we can do better than that.
Okay, let's do better than that. So how would you rewrite Mean Girls?
How would I rewrite Mean Girls?
Would they fall in love? I mean, would you just throw some queerness in it?
Obviously, I would.
Obviously.
It's just a matter of with who. Yeah, I feel like Regina being...
I think it makes way more sense if it becomes a love triangle between like Gretchen, who is Regina's like sexual plaything, but they have no chemistry. And then Caddy comes in and then there is
Caddy,
chemistry. Yeah. Caddy. Yeah.
Or like, what's the girl's name who's played by that actress I have a huge crush on? The girl she keeps accusing of being a lesbian?
Oh, the... Oh wait,
who
no.
I don't remember,
but she's in everything and she's great and she was in the sex show
and
now
so
she's in the Stephen
attractive.
King show and she's just great at everything.
Lizzie Kaplan.
Yes.
Lizzie Kaplan.
Sorry, Lizzie Kaplan.
Janice.
Yes.
If Lizzie Kaplan's character and Regina George have kind of a secret thing going on, and then Caddy comes in, and Caddy and the goth girl have something going on. I think that that's a more interesting reason for Regina to want to destroy her, but also be attracted to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could have just had like a much more hilarious and complicated story. where nobody, like, I think one of the things that's nice about Mean Girls is that ultimately Katie becomes one of them. Like, she really is a mean girl.
Sure, she's fully a plastic.
Yeah, and I thought that that was really believable and successful the way that that's done. But it would be interesting to see her do that, not necessarily in competition for a boy who is clearly gay.
Well, yes, both. I mean, both as
so
is written
pretty.
and in real life, yes.
And in real life, as soon as I saw him as a judge on RuPaul's Drag Race, I was like, yes,
yeah. Well, honey, we all knew, all us little baby gays knew way back in, like, when the movie came out, we were like, oh, yeah.
Actually, you know what would have been great is if they did the plot the exact same way, except for that he's like, ladies, I am gay.
I am very
that
gay.
I would have loved that.
See,
I would have loved that movie so much.
Redo
more.
Mean Girls and it's just everyone's gay. Oops, all gays. It's just
that's how
oops,
I want
all...
to retell everything.
Yes.
And also the plastics wouldn't have all been white.
No, that's also
like,
bad.
Come on.
But that's really also okay. Like 2003. So
yeah, fine. Whatever. Yes. I didn't like it.
I want to briefly mention the fact that you do this kind of conversation regularly now on your new podcast, Failure to Adapt.
Yeah.
Which I am obsessed with. I apologize.
Thank you. Our next episode's an interview with me and Lisa, which Red super generously did, which I think is so kind of him. So a little
so
bit
were
of
a you
stretch.
Were you as harsh about your own writing?
No.
You are easily, this is the only cultural reference that's coming to mind, but you are the Simon Cowell of that show. You are just vicious.
It's not my fault that we keep doing, because we try to find things with like really broad appeal.
Uh-huh.
And things with really broad appeal are always going to be the things that are easiest to critique brutally,
uh-huh.
I feel like.
Sure.
Because they're, you know, kind of made to be milquetoast.
Uh-huh.
You know? Like, and so someone like me is always going to have beef with them. And Red is just a person who likes to have a good time who's normal. And so he comes across something, you know, like the Paula Abdul. But I love making that show. So Failure to Adapt is a show that I co-host with Red Scott, who's a stand-up comedian. We have really different perspectives on what makes something good. I think he's really smart. I really enjoy chatting with him. We text about movies and TV like we're recording a podcast all the time anyway. So it just felt like a natural extension. And we do book to TV or movies adaptations, and we talk about, you know, which was better, what choices did they make, what changes did they make, where are their missed opportunities, etc. And it's fucking fun. It's been a blast. Although we have put a halt to recording for a while because we recorded too far out and now we're like both really tired.
If you had your druthers, would Matt Damon be part of the TV adaptation of Squad? And if so,
no.
How would you kill him?
Oh, he's too old, right? Like, because Squad is about young people.
Yeah, but if it's a TV adaptation and multiple seasons need to happen, surely there's a predatory teacher or something somewhere that
yeah,
Matt Damon can play.
Like a professor at Stanford.
Sure.
You know, with like a little
season
too...
Season 2 when we're following Amanda.
Yeah, who's like a little too familiar with the students,
uh-huh.
The young, pretty girl students.
Yep.
And I don't think that's a big stretch for casting Matt Damon there. But I like, if there was going to be an actor, because I feel like if an actor takes that role where they're like, I want to play the piece of shit who you're going to kill, and I'm going to like enjoy it, and I'm going to like eat the scenery for this one little cameo that I'm going to make, because obviously I'm not here for the whole ride. Like, what straight dude actor would I want to actually give that cred?
Yes.
You know? And it wouldn't be Matt Damon.
Is it Tom Hiddleston? I feel like that's the only other... Like,
he's Loki, right? He's fine.
Yeah.
Who's hilarious? Like, who would be so good at that? You know who'd be? James Marsden. That's who I would cast as like the charismatic professor, because he's like so charming and there's just something kind of off. You're
yeah.
like, you're like too perfect. You're on
so you've seen
Valley.
Dead to Me, right?
Dead to Me?
Yes.
No. I have not.
Okay, go to Netflix.
Is he good in that?
Yes. And he does get killed, and it's great. But that's not a spoiler, because that's the entire conceit of the first season, is that we've killed James Marsden. Oopsie. What do we do about it now? And there's a lot of sapphic tension.
Oh my God, yes, I have. Duh. Yes. Sorry, I love it.
With Christina Applegate and...
Yes! Oh my God, that show's amazing. I had just forgotten the name of it, but then you're like, we killed James Marsden. Yep, yeah. Loved it. Loved it. I love James Marsden. I think he's a perfect corpse. He's always magnificent.
It's the tagline for this episode. I love James Marsden. He makes a perfect corpse.
He does. He's so good at it.
If there is an expansion when it does get its own adaptation, what's something that you couldn't do in graphic novel form that you want to explore on screen?
Oh gosh. That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. Because I feel like graphic novels, you can kind of do anything. I think like jump scares, like it would be fun for the vibes to have a few more jump scares. I think especially if you expanded it such that whatever the central squad is, like if you're following these girls or Amanda and the girls from Stanford, if there's another group of werewolves that they're in competition with, jump scares, which can be accomplished with noise, which you can't do on the page, would be really satisfying and would really help with the like spooky, ooky, ooky vibes, which I love. So I think that would be it. I would want more jump scares and more like gasp moments. Because I think, you know, those are a little harder to make with a graphic novel by merit of you can look ahead to the pictures before you read the text, etc. So there can be a little bit of a mismatch sometimes in the way that timing is accomplished. But in movies or TV, if someone slams a door or like jumps out behind you, like all of that happens at once and you get that suddenness. So, and you know, it's horror. It's horror comedy, but you could, you know, I love that you can do it for both. So, you know, some jump scares that are silly, one jump scare that's really scary. I like it when it's more weighted towards silly ones, though, where you're like, oh, it's you. Love those. Very Goosebumps.
Oh, Goosebumps screwed me up as a kid. I was an animorph kid. I'm a wimp. Yeah, see, oh, you get it.
Oh, I get it. I loved animorphs.
That's the, I'm still upset that of all of the children's properties that have gotten dark and gritty reboots over the years, that nobody has ever done a dark and gritty reboot of Animorphs. And I'm like, listen,
well,
I'm available.
Isn't ending pretty dark and gritty on its own?
Exactly.
Like, it's about war. You don't really
they
have
all
to
die at the end. Like they all sacrifice themselves and die. Like the source is already dark and gritty. Like people die. Like I was 9 reading this and I'm like, this is
Catherine Applegate will come and fuck you up, man.
She will, or whoever ghost wrote those, you know.
No, that was all Catherine Applegate. She did outlines. No, she wrote them
After about the first, I think it's either 16 or 20.
I'm gonna need wrote, citation. This is a Newbery Award winner. You're
the
talking
Wikipedia
about
Wikipedia page, my dear.
Okay,
it is a well-known
Wikipedia.
Thing. Yeah, it's well known. She wrote extensive outlines and then a ghostwriter filled in all the blanks.
Was it her husband? Because it might have been Michael.
I was disappointed as well when I became an adult and realized that. But yeah. Fact check me.
I'm going to ask her.
What? You know her?
I mean, like, I used to do events around the Bay Area for like years and years and years. So I wouldn't say we're like best friends, but we know each other.
If
I would
I'm
feel a little
to
weird
be wrong.
Just contacting her out of the blue and being like, hey baby, did you ghostwrite this? But like if I run into her at a thing, I will ask her.
Hey, this asshole said that you
Yeah. And I'll be like, I defended your honor. And she'll be like, I absolutely had this ghostwritten. And I'll be like, I will see myself out.
I, you know, Wikipedia is not exactly the source of
exactly
all knowledge, and I don't have.
And she's not the kind of person who'd be policing her own Wikipedia page. She's like off living her best life.
Either way, I love those books. They are a treasured formative memory for me. But I wonder, because you are a mom. Mm-hmm. You're a parent. You have a little one now.
True.
What kinds of things... You seem to... I mean, you also write for kids or write for young adults. Mm-hmm. Younger minds, how are you, what has writing in that age group, and sort of living in that sort of world of, young adult fiction, young adult writing, stories for, younger folks being so aware of the perspective of younger people, what is that doing for how is that influencing the way that you raise your little one? What kinds of is it making you more aware of things to avoid, of things to stay away from, cycles you're breaking?
Okay. So I will say I was a children's bookseller for about a decade. Mm-hmm. And then I've basically been interested in telling stories for specifically young people since I graduated from college. In 2007. So that's like a while where that's been my entire focus, my entire life's calling, what makes me passionate. And so I do always come at it with the philosophy that kids are smart and that we should make media that meets them where they're capable of going, as opposed to assuming that kids need to be coddled or kids aren't, you know, able to handle kinds of complexity or make decisions for themselves. And so when I write for kids, I try just to always respect them. And now that I have one and he is not yet two, sometimes I think maybe I overshot it, but then I remember he's still learning words. But it's like, it's amazing. I make that joke just because reading with him is like hilarious, and mostly he's in it for the sounds and the noises that I make and, you know, which books have pictures of trains in them. But, that being said, it's wild how much he's already able to understand about the world. And it's clear how closely he's watching Adam and I for examples of just like, oh, well, monkey see, monkey do, I do what you do. And so sometimes you see your worst habits like mimicked back at you. So now I'm extra aware of not just respecting them, but also not trying to pretend like they are going to be perfect in ways that I was unable to be. I mm-hmm. think a lot of kids lit is very aspirational, and that's great. But I think we also need books for grubby little goblin children like me and like my son now, where we can see ourselves and our many imperfections and accept ourselves for that, which is not to say like, oh, you have, let's fuck off on all self-improvement or whatever. Just that, like, feeling less alone about being a grubby little goblin child now and again is just as important. And so, you know, I guess I'm even more staunch in my desire to write those kinds of stories where characters are morally gray, where people are not necessarily good and bad, and where they make bad decisions and they hurt each other sometimes, not because they're bad people, but because they're learning and they're, you know, dealing with things for the first time. I think it's really easy for adults to forget how intense everything is when you're a kid, because you have to do everything for the first time. It's hard enough even when you've done it a bunch of times to operate responsibly in love or professionally or whatever. But we expect kids to know what to do right away because we read them some like Berenstain Bear books or whatever. I don't know. I want to respect them and I want to give them time to fuck up. That's what I want for kids.
The power of bad decisions.
That makes sense. I feel like I kind of like rambled because I'm so passionate about it. I
appreciate that, because that's the kind of stories that I like to tell as well, is the fact that you are going to make bad decisions. You can't avoid it. Sometimes it's fun to make bad decisions.
So, sometimes it's fun to do bad things for no reason.
like eat boys that are
for a reason though.
That are assholes and say stuff like, hold on, I even wrote it down because I was like, really? Wanna see something cool? And then the thing that the thing he wants to show her is his penis. And I'm like, oh.
Listen, I think has that I've never happened you. To you?
I think because I've, I've hooked up with you.
You know, you fell for it. So did I.
Like,
I just
sometimes they're just pretty and there and want to see something cool. And you're like, I know exactly where this is going. But yes, I would like to see that. Yes, please. Thank you.
Yes. Before we end, I do want to say that those little moments, like all the like little shitty dude moments, every single party, every single one of those are something I have either experienced or witnessed. And so I hope people check out Squad.
There I do is too.
Some emotional
so
realism against all of this goofiness.
When I got my signed copy, which was very personalized to me and doesn't have my name there, but one day it will be.
Was it supposed to be personalized to you?
No, my God.
Oh,
stop.
Okay. I was
no.
like, oh, no.
I just bought it as soon as I saw that there were signed copies available. No, oh, okay. I got in my car and I drove to the nearest cemetery so I could take photos for you.
I saw that. That's fucking dedication. And I was touched. If you're not taking selfies with my book in a graveyard.
In a graveyard.
What are you doing? Are we friends? Even?
Yep. Maggie Takuta Hall, thank you so much for being here. I know that your time is precious, and I am so grateful to have this time with you. If folks want to find more about you, more about Squad, and more about all the work that you do, where can they do that?
You can find me online on my website, prettyokmaggie.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at EMTEEHALL or on TikTok now, where I'm still learning, but you can find me at Maggie Takuta Hall.
Oh, please. Oh, please. I'm learning. This maven of social media went viral in like a day and a half. Like, you are I hate you. You're just so good at it. Thank you so much for being here. All of the best.
Thanks.
Congratulations on
me.
Squad and all of the best success on everything going forward.
Congratulations on the release of your debut book as well, A Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft.
Yes.
My copy has arrived and I'm very excited about it.
Oh, well, thank you. I would have just sent you one. I didn't know you were interested in my book, or I would have just sent you one. But thank you.
Oh, you're very sweet. No, you make people buy your book.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. buy my book. Damn it.
There you go. That's right. There you go.
Speaking of, not to like summon her twice in one conversation, but she did text me last night.
Oh, she loves being summoned.
She texted me last night and she said, you know, you have to shake the can and make people go like review your book now, right? You have to talk about your book on social media. I was like,
yes.
Oh, but I feel bad. I feel like I'm just kind of in everybody's face with it all the time. She's like, no, do
it. You know what? It has been so affirming to me is I've been like fucking obnoxious on social media, banging the drum, doing the thing that you tell authors to do, whatever. And then 2 days after Squad came out, somebody who interacts with me all the time was like, oh, you have a new book out? And I was like, see, this is why you have to just keep screaming.
Yeah. Somebody who's followed me for years was like, you have a podcast? I was like, for like 12 years now, yes.
Two times a week, but okay, cool. Yeah, there it is. Yeah, people have no idea. It's fine. Tell everyone about your book. Get those coins, Firelight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, rioters, that's going to do it here for us today. Inciting a Squad Riot, I'd like to thank my guest, Maggie Takuta Hall, for coming back and chatting with me a bit, celebrating the success of her new graphic novel, Squad, which is available everywhere books are sold. If you like this podcast and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Please consider liking and sharing the show on social media. I know you might not think that a quick like or share can do much, but I do promise that it bumps it up in the algorithm and helps other people find it. A big boost would be to rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. If you're already using your iPhone or whatever, just Just, you know, quick little button. It's just right there. please help keep the show free and producing on a regular basis by chipping in whatever you can. You could buy me a coffee, which is a one-time donation of your choosing, or join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and monthly chats with special guests. You can sign up at patreon.com/incitingariot. And of course, my new book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, is available everywhere books are sold. Please, if you like it at all, go leave a review on Amazon or Goodreads, or just tell a friend. If money is a prohibitive factor, please don't let it be. I highly, highly, highly encourage you to go seek out your local library and request that they get a copy of it in. If they don't have a copy or it can't get in time, usually they can get it from another library. So you get to read the books you want and you didn't have to pay anything. It's already there. It's tax dollars already paying for it for you. Support your local library. Anyways, if you'd like to email me about this episode or any other, my email address is firelight, that's F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. Incitingariot.com is also the home for the show notes and the occasional blog. If you would like to connect with me on social media, I'm pretty much at Inciting a Riot everywhere. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook still, sort of, though I'm pretty sure that's going away in 2022, as well as TikTok. So you can find me in all sorts of places. However, you're not going to find me here much longer because I'm going to leave you. But as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.